time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for July 6th, 2019. If you're here in the States, I hope you had a fabulous Independence Day on Thursday. Elsewhere, I hope you're enjoying a great summer. Last week, we reported on the death of Robin Heitman, a 20-year-old messenger, bicycle ambassador, and evidently an up-and-coming competitive cyclist in New York City. Then, three more cyclists were killed in rapid succession in New York City, and that brought the total for 2019 to 15. In all of 2018, there were 10 cycling deaths in the city. Interestingly enough, New York City has a Vision Zero program on the books and a fairly large number of laws that seem to go unenforced. Or at least, that's what you'd be led to believe when the New York Police Department published a notice that said they would enforce the traffic laws for 3 weeks beginning July 1st and ending July 21st. Does that sound as ludicrous to you as it does to me? If the laws are on the books, why aren't they enforced all the time? Why does it take multiple deaths to decide to enforce already in place laws? And why did the police take the opportunity immediately after a high profile incident such as Robin's to begin ticketing cyclists in the area of the crash? Well, I actually have some answers. I spoke with someone who has some of the answers and understands the situation pretty well, including being one of those cyclists who was ticketed for an infraction. Aaron Gordon is a senior investigative reporter for Jalopnik. Yep, it's a car-centered organization, yet he thinks that the work he's doing now helps to inform his reporting on the many sides of transportation he covers. Aaron is my first guest this evening. We're going to take a break for station ID after we talk with Aaron, and we'll do a little bit of news. And then, as the Tour de France kicks off today in Brussels, and with the untimely loss of Paul Sherwin last year, I thought it might be appropriate to bring you an encore presentation of my 2014 conversation with the voice of the Tour, Phil Liggett. So let's talk with Aaron Gordon about what the NYPD is planning to do. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. So, you know, I follow Peter Flax on Twitter, and he posted something that you wrote that I just needed to talk with you about. So before we actually talk about this cool piece that you wrote, what is Jalopnik? You write for them.
Yeah, so I don't imagine Jalopnik will be familiar to a lot of your listeners. It's an automotive-focused website, but basically a car enthusiast website, more or less. But we cover transportation broadly as well. And I personally have no automotive reporting background. I was a transportation reporter covering the New York City subway before they hired me, but my role with them is a senior investigative reporter, and I cover a lot more than just cars. Actually, I very rarely cover cars. So yeah, it's kind of a weird mix.
And it's one. It looks like it's one of Gizmodo's properties.
That's right. It's one of the many Gizmodo sites, along with Gizmodo, Jezebel, Deadspin, that family of websites. Yeah.
Cool. Well, and of course, I didn't know what it was. I did kind of look it up, but I couldn't quite get it from the site that I was looking at, because what I was doing was reading your article, which was titled "America's Largest City Said It Will Enforce Traffic Laws for 3 Weeks." Then all other time purge. So what's really funny is, I guess the first half of it, it's going to enforce the traffic laws for 3 weeks. Really? I don't quite get it. So there have been a lot of crashes in New York. Dead cyclists. Robin Heitman was one of the most high profile last week. What's happening with the traffic laws right now?
Yeah, so I guess there's kind of like a larger context to place this article within, which is New York City is one of the many cities in the world that has signed on to this Vision Bureau commitment, which is a commitment to eliminate all traffic-related deaths by a certain time. And New York's pledge, I believe, is 2023, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh.
And it's one of, which, you know, it's more of an aspirational goal, but it's a commitment from the current administration to reduce the number of traffic deaths to as close to zero as humanly, is the way I interpret it. Not as like a, we literally promise zero traffic deaths, because that's not something that's within any mayor's control. But anyways, it's been a staple policy, a kind of headline policy of this administration, of Mayor de Blasio, who some may know, he's one of the dozens of people running for president under the Democratic ticket at the moment. And so that it's been a signature policy of his. And for the most part, traffic deaths have been on a negative trend, but a lot of that is the result of policies put into place by de Blasio's predecessor, Mayor Bloomberg,
right,
who's actually quite progressive on street safety issues and the installation of protected bike lanes and things like that. De Blasio's administration has not been as aggressive on those fronts. So he's been kind of criticized for a lot of that for a long time. And the reason why this is kind of coming up now is that 10 cyclists died last year in the city getting hit by cars. And so far this year, there have been 15. And obviously, we're only in the beginning of July. So there are a lot more this year than there were last year. And it seems like it's bringing to the fore a lot of cyclist concerns in the city that the death statistic is not the best way to measure how safe it is to cycle in the city. And actually, it feels very unsafe a lot of the time. And the margin for error often feels very thin. And what we, you know, what a lot of cyclists in the city feel is that this 15 death statistic and growing is more emblematic of what it feels like to really ride in the city than the 10 deaths or the Vision Zero pledge does. And so, yeah, Robin, I believe, was the 12th cyclist to die. And then in the week that followed, three more died. So it very much is a major issue.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Aaron Gordon. He's an investigative reporter with a site called Jalopnik, which is interesting unto itself. I just read that Lee Iacocca died, for example. I would not necessarily have known that without looking at it today.
Yes.
Yeah. But back to the story here. So suddenly we've got this, let's enforce existing traffic laws, which is really kind of bizarre, for 3 weeks. So I just can't even imagine. These laws are on the books. Why haven't they been enforcing these laws right along? Why are they suddenly making a big deal out of it? Or why are they putting a 3-week limit to it?
Yeah, so one of the reasons that it feels often unsafe to cycle on New York City streets is because the traffic laws are often not enforced. And when I say traffic laws here, I'm talking about ones that are meant to promote street safety and give cyclists a safe space to ride. So I'm thinking of laws that don't allow people to park in the bike lane, that, well, speeding, of course, is a major one. Illegal right turns on red, which is not legal in New York City because we really need that dedicated time for people to cross the street in crosswalks. Other types of moving violations, parking on sidewalks, parking, you know, where people shouldn't park, just all types of moving violations like that. They're all designed to make cycling and walking around the city safer, and they're just not enforced. Anytime, on every single time I go for a ride in the city, I rarely make it 5 blocks before coming across a car parked in a bike lane. Usually I'll hit one within a block or two. Often there will be entire bike lanes blocked with cars parked in them. And they almost never get tickets for it. In fact, the police themselves are often guilty of parking in bike lanes. That's a very, very common sight in the city. So to kind of back up and answer your question about why enforce laws that already exist, It's because they aren't enforced. And a lot of times that's just the reality of riding a bike in the city. And sometimes it has deadly consequences. Last year, a woman, a tourist from Australia, was killed riding up Central Park West.
Right.
And the reason she was killed was because she had to veer out of the bike lane to avoid a taxi that had pulled up and parked in the bike lane. And then she got hit by a truck coming in the opposite direction.
Yeah, so I remember that one.
Really awful. Yeah, it's really awful. And so those types of dangers are things that we experience all the time. And then by 3 weeks, I don't have a great answer for you on that one. I think it's just kind of an arbitrary amount of time that NYPD came up with when the mayor told them that they needed to do something because cyclists were dying on the street. He was getting a lot of political flack for it.
They might have just left off the words 3 weeks and just said they'll continue to enforce the traffic laws, but they didn't. One of the NYPD strategies in this list that was published also interests me, and that's patrol supervisors will respond to a scene of a bicyclist / pedestrian struck in order to conduct a thorough investigation on whether Administrative Code 19-190 right-of-way law has been violated. And we know that oftentimes either the cyclist or pedestrian is injured or unconscious, and so the police doing their preliminary investigation will talk with either the person who hit the cyclist in this case or witnesses, and not actually talk to the person who, of course, if they're not alive, they can't talk to them. And then the investigation doesn't seem to go anywhere. Is that an experience you know about? Do you know anything about that?
Oh, absolutely. So there's a template that NYPD follows after a cyclist has been killed by a driver. The first thing they do is they go to the scene and they clean up the body. And the second thing they do is reopen the street to car traffic. And then they interview, they go through the administrative steps you mentioned, like interviewing any potential witnesses that are there. Sometimes they'll go to nearby stores to see if they have any security camera footage that might be, you know, facing the street, things like that. But for the most part, they rarely find anything, sometimes because they don't look very hard. And then typically they let the driver go home. They don't charge him with anything at the scene and rarely charge him with anything on a follow-up. And then the next day, they will launch a ticketing blitz against cyclists in that very block or, you know, that square block radius, where they will post officers to ticket cyclists for infractions, you know, maybe if they run a red light or if they don't look both ways before stopping in a stop sign, if they don't have a bell on their bike, whatever, they'll get a ticket for it. So what ends up happening is, and the people most punished from, you know, by law, when a cyclist dies, tends to be other cyclists. It's very, very rare for a driver to be charged with any crime after hitting a cyclist, killing a cyclist. And if they are charged, it's typically a misdemeanor. The right-of-way law you mentioned is not a felony. I'm not one who thinks we should be running around charging people with felonies when they don't intend. Like, I think it's a complicated subject about whether to charge drivers who have killed cyclists with felonies. I'm not saying that's the answer to everything. But I think it is noteworthy that drivers rarely are punished in any way for killing cyclists. And so this is a kind of cycle we see in this city quite often. And one of the things that frustrates cyclists the most is the ticketing of cyclists after a cyclist has been killed, right? It has like this victim blaming air to it where it's like, you know, what are we, like, if we get hit by a truck, how is that our fault type of attitude?
It's interesting that some of the semantics of what happened with Robin were that she was hit by a truck as opposed to by the truck driver. You know, like the truck right. on its own, you know, hit her. And so even though that's a, you know, a semantic, a very difference of the wording, the impact is so different. And it's just bizarre to me. So they do ticket cyclists. So that is not a That is not something that somebody's just saying. It really does happen. I mean, we've heard this before, but I'm in Cleveland, you're in New York, and it gets reported that, oh, yeah, now they're ticketing cyclists in the same area. But it does happen, and that's really disturbing to me. Really disturbing.
I mean, I can tell you a short anecdote here of my own experience. I mean, first of all, it absolutely happens. This is not a conspiracy theory. The NYPD has admitted this is what they do. They say they're revisiting that policy. I don't expect anything to come of that.
Yeah, right.
It's a definite thing. But a couple of years ago, I was biking on my way to work, and I came to a stop at a red light. And one thing about biking in New York, and I think this is true of a lot of cities, when you don't have a very much dedicated space, you have to make the best use of the space that you have. And one of the things that, and this is the reason why a lot of cyclists run red lights after coming to stop, because we don't want to be given a green light at the same time as a car, because then we have to compete with any obstructions in the next half block with that car with very little space to maneuver. And I was in one of those spaces, and I saw there was a car parked in a bike lane, you know, 200 feet after the light. So I thought, I don't want to compete with this car, you know, as I'm coming up against that parked car. So I ran the red light when there was no traffic going in either way. You know, there were no cars within sight. It was, but anyways, I got a ticket for it. And I'm not saying I shouldn't get a ticket for it, but what I remember about that instance is that when I explained why I'd run the red light to the police officer, and I said, it'd be great if we could get a protected bike lane around here so that I don't have to do this. He said, well, a young girl was struck and killed at that very intersection last week, which is why we are ticketing people here to make sure they're following the law. And I thought that was odd, because I remembered from a news, I read about that story. You know, I'm a local reporter. I stay abreast of what's going on in the city. And that girl was hit by a car. And she was hit by a car making it, you know, running a red light through that intersection.
Uh-huh.
So it was just very strict. So like I mentioned that to him, and he just said, well, we want to make sure everybody follows the law. You know, he gave that, like, you know, but at the same time, he was not in a vehicle that could actually pursue and give a ticket to a car. He was in one of those little electric three-wheel things. I don't know what they're called, the interceptors. So, you know, it was pretty clear what was going on. And so that's, you know, just an anecdote from my own experience, but that's regular behavior by the NYPD around what happens after a vision zero death, as they call it.
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Aaron Gordon. He is an investigative reporter for Jalopnik, and we're talking about the article that he wrote, America's Largest City Says It Will Enforce Traffic Laws for 3 weeks. It still blows my mind. So what do you mean by all other time the purge?
Well, so that's kind of a reference to the movie, the Purge series of movies, where basically anyone's allowed to do whatever they want for one day a year, including commit like violent crimes and all that stuff. And it's kind of a reference to the fact that New York is just like that all the time. And I think the kind of like deeper cut reference, and not deeper cut, but if you think about it for a little bit longer, you know, there's been a morbid joke in the city for as long as I've been here among cyclists, that if you want to kill someone in the city and not go to jail for it, the absolute best way to do so is get in your car and run over a cyclist. Because as I mentioned earlier, there's basically no chance you're going to be charged with a felony. There's a small chance you might be charged with a misdemeanor. But ultimately, almost every driver who runs over and kills a cyclist is let go. They literally go home immediately afterwards, charged with nothing.
Let me explain, though, that New York City is not the only place that happens. It happens across the country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a huge problem.
It's pathetic.
And I think it in New York, you know, this is certainly true of large cities that are dealing with, you know, huge traffic problems and, you know, want to achieve certain climate related goals and just are very dense and cycling is becoming more popular. There's this huge paradox between the encouragement of people to cycle more and also the fact that the city is not taking the necessary steps to make them feel safe while doing so. That certainly is true in a lot of cities around the country, though.
It is. And I mean, unfortunately, I have the ugly job of reporting on it because listeners, as soon as somebody's hit, I get an email or I get a notice on Facebook or I get a message. that says, this is what happened. And then when I follow the story, most of the time, occasionally somebody pays for it. Somebody who's just had 17 DUIs and, you know, took out 8 cyclists or whatever. But even that doesn't always guarantee that somebody's going to be prosecuted and pay for those kinds of problems. So what do you think a solution might be? Do you see anything that might change the way things are going?
Well, there's not a lot of reason for optimism at the moment. But
oh, that's sad.
But the good news is, I think and that's mostly just because Mayor de Blasio still has a few more years left on his term. And he has demonstrated through his years as mayor of the city that he really doesn't care about this issue and doesn't understand it, doesn't fundamentally understand that this is a street design issue. And this is where I land on it. And, you know, I think working for an car-focused website has actually helped me understand some things a little bit better than I used to. And one of the things I've come to realize is that nobody gets in their car in the morning in city, you know, especially in cities like New York, thinking, I want to kill a cyclist today. You know, more of a joke aside, no truck driver gets in the car in the morning and thinks, I don't want to make this delivery. I want to kill a cyclist instead.
Right.
The problem is, and the reason why there are so many laws that NYPD has to enforce regarding traffic safety to the point where they end up not enforcing any of them is that all of these different modes of transportation are competing for the same scarce space. And as long as the very design of the street kind of forces cyclists and trucks and parked cars and other, you know, types of transportation to compete for the same physical space, there's going to be conflict. And that conflict is going to result in people dying when, you know, a cyclist is, you know, hit by a much larger vehicle. So the only solution is just better street design. And the really pathetic thing to me is that not only are there lots of examples around the world, as I'm sure you and your listeners are aware, where cities have figured this out. They know how to design cities for safe usage for cyclists, for pedestrians, and for vehicles all at the same time. But we have those examples right here in New York. There's a wonderful stretch of bike lanes along Allen Street in Manhattan, where the cycle path runs down a grassy median as, you know, cement trucks and whatever kind of construction equipment run, you know, is in the street. And there are just examples throughout the city where for a few blocks, the city gets it right. And it is endlessly frustrating to me that the rest of the city can't or won't be like that until this administration realizes that street design is really the only answer here. And that, you know, jokes of 3-week ticketing blitzes aside, like even permanent ticketing blitzes still wouldn't solve the problem.
Right. So there was so much progress when Bloomberg was mayor. To see this kind of sort of backward slide is really disappointing. We used to look to New York for positive things. So it is disappointing to me to see it. So if he's running for, we know he's running for president. Do you think that cyclists and pedestrians and other people, that there are enough people in New York City, this is going to be one of those opinion questions. In your opinion, do you think that they could have a large enough voice to get the right person back in office?
Are you talking about in the next mayoral election?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, well, first of all, the next mayoral election isn't for another 2 years, I think. So we got, so, you know, things can always change. But I think there are a lot of really strong, so aside from street safety and cyclist issues, transportation has been a huge focus of the city over the last couple of years. As I'm sure even people who don't live in New York are aware of, like, the, you know, viral videos that have gone around of our subway being flooded with water.
Right.
And, like, you know,
sure,
huge crowds and all that stuff. Like, just the breakdown of getting places in the city has been a huge topic of conversation. And there are some strong candidates who have lined up for the next election who do seem to understand the issue a lot better than Mayor de Blasio. Low bar, but you know, the name that most comes to mind is the City Council Speaker Corey Johnson, who I've interviewed a few times, and he put out a robust kind of transportation revisioning of the city, which included a lot of talk about safe streets and street issues and those kinds of things that he can't really control as City Council Speaker, But if he were mayor, he would have direct control of the Department of Transportation, which does control these issues. And so I think people like Speaker Johnson, when they put their hat forward, know they have to be strong on these issues because they matter to a lot of New Yorkers. So yeah, to answer your question, that's where my optimism comes in, you know, not maybe for the next year or two, but what might happen if we get a mayor who really gets it, then things could start changing.
We would like to see that. Well, I really appreciate you talking with me about this. It's such a horrible subject on the one hand, but yet I think if there's enough momentum around the country in cities like New York and cities like LA and cities like even like Cleveland, you know, it's starting to move forward with different thinking about infrastructure and transportation. Hopefully it'll actually get somewhere. Thanks so much for talking with me, Aaron.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
All right. You take care.
All right. You too. Bye.
Aaron Gordon joined me from the offices of Jalopnik. If you're interested in his article, you can go to Jalopnik, that's JALOPNIK.com, and look for the story, America's Largest City Says It Will Enforce the Traffic Laws for 3 Weeks. So let's take a break, and when we come back, I'll have a couple of short news items before our encore presentation of my conversation with the voice of the tour, Phil Liggett. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. I told you I'd have a couple of news items, and here we go. It isn't too often that I hear a story on Terry Gross's show, Fresh Air, that is so pertinent to the work that I do. But on June 18th, she aired an episode about Major Taylor with investigative reporter and author Michael Cranish. His new book is titled The World's Fastest Man. If you're interested, you can find and listen to the podcast at npr.org and look for the Fresh Air podcasts. Then as the Tour de France gets underway today, it will do so without the familiar face of Mark Cavendish. Cavendish had raced the event every year since 2007 and has 30 stage wins under his helmet. Yet his team, Dimension Data, excluded his name when the team roster was announced earlier this week. Cavendish, who believes his training peaked exactly as he'd planned to participate in the tour this year, was, as you can imagine, crushed. If you're interested, you can read Gregor Brown's article titled Cavendish Says He Was in Perfect Place to Race the Tour in VeloNews.com online. We're going to take another real short break, and when we come back, we'll hear the encore presentation of my conversation from 2014 with Phil Liggett. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. So without Cavendish, but with a grand start this morning in Brussels, here is the encore presentation of my conversation with the voice of the tour, Phil Liggett, from 2014. Sit back, get ready for a fun hour of cycling conversation as we begin with the one and only Phil Liggett. Phil, thanks for being on The Outspoken Cyclist this week.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, Diana, I can assure you. It's lovely to speak to you.
Oh, nice. How's Mr. Sherwin?
I haven't spoken to him since Paris-Roubaix, apart from a couple of emails between us. But we'll catch up on the upcoming Amgen Tour of California.
So you are on your way here?
Yeah, will be. I'm just going to have a few days holiday on the east coast of England, on the bike, of course.
Of course.
And then I'm coming over to California.
Oh, I wish I could come out to the event. We talked about my going out, but it's just not going to happen this year. So let's talk a little bit about Phil Liggett. That's the most important thing today. Tell us a little bit about your beginning in cycling and riding and amateur racing. When did you start competing, and then when did that change to journalism?
Well, I started riding a bike probably when I was around about 13, 14 years of age, but that was purely to either go fishing or to go to school. I rode to school every day of my senior life except one day, and that was a Wednesday. I didn't ride at all, so that's how I remember it. But basically, I was useless at all school sport. In England, of course, we played cricket. I was useless. Football, soccer, all terrible. But I found I could ride a bike, so they gave me time off on the sports lessons to go for a ride, and eventually joined the club. Wanted to race, tried my hand at it, found I was doing pretty okay. So I rode my first race at the end of my 17th year. So I didn't get long as a junior cyclist before I was thrown in at the deep end. And I raced for about 8 years as a top-level cyclist. But during that time, I was also writing a little bit, and it hadn't gone unnoticed. And while I was living in Belgium trying to ply my trade to be a professional cyclist, I did ring up a newspaper and said, hey, you never talk about these guys who are living off the money they win trying to be a pro bike rider. And they said, we can't afford it. If you think it's useful, write a story. So I did. And on the strength of those stories, within about 2 years, I was offered a job in Fleet Street as a journalist. And I took the job and not the pro contract. And then that was the whole directional change for me. In the longer term, I stopped cycling, but I never lost my love for it at all.
Do you have any regrets?
No, none at all. Oh, I would have loved to have been a very successful pro because that was my life. But no, on the contrary. But it was never an ambition to be a television commentator. It came, it fell in my lap in 1978. I took it with open arms, and I really enjoyed doing it. And I enjoyed selling the sport and the pastime to the world, because they didn't know about it. Nowadays, cycling is so popular now. I'm probably not as necessary now as I was then. But I wanted the sport and the pastime to grow, and it did. The times I was told by colleagues in other forms of job, saying, why do you waste your time? You'll never earn any money talking cycling. It's never going to happen for you. But it did happen for me, and I felt like a little bit of a pioneer.
You are only the most famous voice in our sport. Come on. Everybody recognizes your voice. Everybody recognizes how you say things. I love it. In fact, during Paris-Roubaix, I was using the Twitter system, and when you would say something, I would repeat it because it was so funny. So I think one of the most impressive things about your work is just the amount of knowledge you have about riders and teams and courses and individual races. And Paul Sherwin, when I spoke with him, told me a little bit about it, but how do you keep it all straight?
Well, we designed Paul and I together, but Paul started commentating alongside me at the end of his pro career back in 85, 86. And, of course, he was a cyclist and in no basic background as being a journalist or a pundit. But we blended well together because we were brought up, although it was 12 years apart in our age, we were brought up in the same area. So I knew him towards the end of his amateur career. And, in fact, I was the guest of honour at his club dinner when they were sending him off to France to try and become a pro. And I remember wishing him well then. 10 years later, I was asking him if he wanted to work with me on television, and he said he would love to give it a try. So that was it. And then Paul and I devised a program on a computer which recorded all the results of the riders. And I mean, I do it to this day, every day of my life. First thing when I get up is to just check the previous day's results, put them all on the files, suspensions, riders who have crashed, put it all, little notes on the file, so it's there ready for whenever I'm asked to do something. So people think I must work day and night to prepare for the Tour de France, but I don't, because it's already done. I've been doing it every day forever. And so I just call up the riders required, and all the facts and figures are in front of me. But it's a pleasure to do. I've always been a kind of statistician. Before I became a journalist, I was a statistical accountant. It's my job to work in figures and to work things out. And And I still, to this day, love to do facts and figures. And so I find it a pleasure and not a chore to work out how many times this guy's finished third in Paris-Roubaix or how many times he's won it or whatever, you know, or ridden it. And yeah, it's something I do naturally and I just love doing it.
Well, it seems so seamless. You know, you have all of this information right there. And even if it's computerized, when the cameras come on you, all you have is a microphone in your hand. So I don't know where you're hiding all this stuff. You do a good job of
it. No, it's mostly in the mind, and that's I love live television because there's a nervousness about it, just like if you're starting in a world championship bicycle race, because if you make a serious error, well, you lose your job. It's as simple as that in the days of political correctness and all that. But you obviously, occasionally you slip up, you get the odd fact wrong, or you get your facts confused because you know too much at the end of the day. And the real fans are quite critical of that, but I don't get too many of those. The vast majority of people just love to be entertained and to feel that they don't have to know the sport in depth to understand and enjoy the spectacle on television. And they're the people I love to be watching, you know. The mum who, I don't want her to go out and make a cup of tea till the commercials come on. I want her to stay and enjoy it. And around the world, the countless men who stop me in the streets and say, the only reason my wife's watched cycling is because you're doing the commentary. And that's a big compliment to me, and I love to hear that sort of thing.
It is true. People say, well, is Phil Liggett going to be announcing? Okay, then I'll listen. And you know who else has become pretty funny, and that's Bob Roll. He's a pretty funny guy.
Yeah, but I love Bob a lot. I remember when Bob was racing in Britain as a pro when he was with 7-Eleven, he almost won the race in Cardiff Castle in Wales, and he pulled his foot off the pedal. And he lost the race. He was second. It was a two-man sprint. And, well, Bob's language was, shall we say, colourful. And I wouldn't go near him. So I sent Sherwin. I said, you can go and interview him because I'm not going near that man. He's an angry boy. And that was our first sort of meeting with Bob. And then we came together on Versus, and which became the NBCSN network. And then we're friends now. Bob is a terrific guy, highly intelligent man. He really is an intelligent person, but you never know when he's telling you the truth or just concocting a story. You just don't know. But I've done lots of dinners and talks with him, and he's a laugh a minute. He's a terrific character.
Yeah, he is. He's really. I haven't been able to get my hands on him yet, but I think I will eventually.
Oh, keep trying, because Bob is not slow in coming forward. If he can get himself on the radio, he's fine.
I'll keep trying. You know, I'll bug you and Paulie to get me some contact information. I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Phil Liggett. He's over in England getting ready to come over to the States for the Amgen Tour this year. So I want to ask you a question about all these years you've been involved in cycling. What do you think are some of the biggest changes you've seen? Maybe the teams, equipment, just the sport itself. What has changed most profoundly?
Well, from my day, which sounds a long time ago now, I mean, riders then were pioneers, especially going from Great Britain. The Americans were almost unheard of as coming into Europe. Literally one or two used to race in the peloton while I lived in Belgium. But the changes now, of course, it started. First of all, there was an offer of £1,000 by the bicycle industry over in Britain for anybody who could design a bike different to the famous diamond shape of a bicycle frame, because everybody thought the ultimate design had been discovered. Of course, once the money went on the table, cycling has never been slow in getting technically into the game, especially with the lightest materials, like the use of the metals in Concorde and in the space shuttle and all that. And so they eventually did design a bicycle a different shape. And so it went on. Then came the pedals change. In the mid-80s, Bernard Hinault started riding these ski-type cleats, of which I meant you were doing away with the toe clip. That was a radical change. And in fact, Sean Kelly, the great Irish cyclist at the time, the world number one, he wouldn't contemplate not using toe clips. He didn't believe in that sort of stuff. And the only reason he ever did change was because he was causing too much inconvenience to the mechanics to have to put a special bike on the car with toe clips on, because everybody was now riding these ski binding type fittings. Well, that was the start. That was a major change. And then, of course, the movement of the gear shifts going up onto the brake levers, because then you couldn't see when the guy was making a reach for his gear lift. And then you would jump him normally in the spin. If you saw his hand going down to get the higher gear, you had a half a second to get the drop on him. But now, riding a bicycle with the shifts on the gear levers, you didn't see his hands move when you're behind him, so you never knew when he was moving the gears. And that was a terrific increase as well, and big changes. And the other one was, of course, the Boone Lennon-type handlebars, which won Greg LeMond the Tour de France in 1989, and that made one-piece handlebar. That was the next big shift. All those changes followed then by the lighter bicycles, which caused the governing bodies to make a weight limit on the bicycles, otherwise you'd literally get blown away. They were making them so light. And the changes were big. Well, look, sport's got to progress. Nobody can dispute that. But I must prefer the older days when it was the man who was having to get that bicycle, whatever condition it was in, across the line in the first place. I don't think we should go back to the old days when you're having to mend your forks at the mill and keep going and have to work hard to stay at the front of the race in that respect, or walk up a climb that's too steep to ride up. But I think the sport's become so streamlined now, to a degree, it's become boring, even though it's equally as hard as it always was. And now, of course, the latest trend now is to take the pressure off, is to do away with three-week grand tours and make them only 2 weeks. But then you're taking away the very heart of the sport, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, a couple of 3 years ago, I spoke with Eric Heiden, and he thought that one of the most profound changes was the race radio, and he didn't like it. What do you think about that?
No, I'm an absolute no-no as well. Always have been. I get occasionally ridiculed because the managers say, no, we need it for security, for safety. I say, well, that's fine. But then let's have the same frequency so every rider hears the same comment. Rather than you being able to speak to your man, then it wasn't so keen then. Because if a race referee can talk to all the riders at the same time, that completely eliminates the problems with safety. Because you can say, peloton, there's a lorry broken down around the corner. Everybody attention. That's fine. But if you, when the team managers are actually all but riding the bikes for their charges, you know, they've got televisions in the car, they see who's on the front of the peloton, they know they're getting a bit twitchy to attack, and they're immediately telling their riders, get up behind Fabian Cancellara, he's going to go any moment. Well, that's robotic racing as far as I'm concerned. I like them to think for themselves, and that way occasionally they make mistakes, and it makes for a better race.
So are there any riders who you think today are thinking for themselves and don't really care about having all that information? Who do you think is at the top of that list?
Oh, there most certainly are. I mean, there are riders nowadays who pull the earpiece out of their ears because they're fed up with the manager shouting at them and telling them where to go and what to do. And there are riders who read races extremely well. And I think also because they seem to have cracked the drugs problem within the peloton, these guys now are visibly, they don't have endless numbers of attacks in those legs. So they've got to make only one or maybe two attacks and their day is done. So they're having to gauge their moves much more precisely now. And you can tell on their faces, they are right up to the limit of their effort at times. And if they make the wrong move and sell out, they don't get a second chance at winning the race. And so those guys now aren't robots anymore, because they can't, when the management is shouting attack and then go again, these guys can't do it anymore physically, which is good for the sport. And I think this year we've seen it in the classic racing, that we've seen some really good one-day classics this year, very unpredictable in the results and very exciting. And I think, and I hope, that's down to the fact that there's not so much drugs inside the peloton now.
So have you got a favorite team for the tour this year?
You know, I've never had heroes in my life. I've admired people, and I never really have favorites. I mean, that's one of the bonuses. If you're a television commentator, you shouldn't be leaning one side or the other. And in cycling, you know, I mean, I enjoy certain people. I always enjoyed the Australian Robin McEwen when he came out of the middle of nowhere, unseen, in the last 200 meters, and he won more than 200 races. But I've got no real favorite people or teams. I like to see Orica GreenEdge do well because I have a close affinity with Australia. I know the guy who owns the team, and I know how much money he's put in purely for philanthropic reasons, and therefore I like to see when he has success, but I'm not going to call him any more excitable than I would if I was calling somebody from, say, FDJ or Etix. And also that this year, for me, the big the team I just really want to just show me their heart is the African squad, MTN Gobeka.
Yes.
Because this is a huge happening for African cycling this year, and they won't be anonymous. And for the kids on the team, most of them, some of them have already ridden the tour because they've been brought into the squad. But for the African kids, this is going to be an amazing 3 weeks in July.
Yes, I'm very excited about that, too. I've spoken with Jacques and Kimberly over the years, and we've been watching them. And someday, they're going to be on the podium.
Oh, they will.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And when I said favorite, I didn't mean for you to favor them. I meant, did you think there was somebody who was going to shine this year on the podium? Do you see any team doing better than some of the others? That I didn't mean personal favorite.
It's very difficult. I mean, the Etics boys obviously have candidates, but basically I don't think they can win the tour this year, personally. But they'll win stages, obviously. Sky will be a tough side to beat. I can't make my mind up about Chris Froome, who's a friend. I call him a friend, but he's falling off his bike, and he's just fallen off again just last weekend as well. In the Flesh Will On this week, rather. So I don't know whether he's got to win the tour again. But as a team, Sky's tactics often is questionable. They seem to try to ride the race off their back wheels, and you can't do that at the moment. On the other hand, I think these new teams have got off to a good start. And Katusha, who's once been on the sort of wrong side of the world body, if you like, now becoming at the moment, along with Movistar, one of the top teams of the year. And I would expect to see Katusha riding a very good Tour de France.
Let me once again remind our listeners, we're speaking with Phil Liggett, and the next topic we are going to talk about is back to Africa. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was because of your yellow jersey and saving the rhinos. This whole situation with poaching and killing these animals is killing me. So tell us a little bit about your Save the Rhinos campaign, because you are involved and I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I am. I've always loved animals. I've always said I worked with them. I'm only joking. But on the other hand, animals and bikes somehow go together. I've used my bike to go bird watching, which I'm a patron of BirdLife South Africa and a fellow of the BirdLife Association here in Britain. And then with the animals, I got involved with the rhinos because I met a guy who worked for American Express at the very top, and he threw his whole job in to form this helpingrhinos.org, which I'm a patron. And I've been drawn in by him. I started to look at the situation firsthand because I'm a very lucky person. I have a farm in the edge of the Kruger Park in South Africa. And we have rhino. And one day Romeo turned up with Juliet and a calf, and the poachers killed Juliet and the calf. They didn't catch Romeo. When we started to protect Romeo, we put a transmitter on him and a collar on him. And I actually helped roll him over to 10 men, the Dark Romeo. And you've got 20 minutes when the dark goes in to do what you have to do and run, because they're never put out completely, because rhinos, even though they weigh 3 tons, are actually very delicate and too much treatment on the dart, and they literally die. So Romeo's doing fine now, 2 years down the line. But during those 2.5-3 years, over 2,000 rhino have been hacked to death by poachers in the Kruger Park itself, which is absolutely ridiculous. Because it's for no reason. The people in Vietnam particularly, and in China, Asia in general, they believe what is actually only fingernail hair on the horn has magic qualities to do all sorts of things and affect curing cancer as well. And it's absolute load of rubbish. And yet there's the syndicates and underworld gangs who pay literally more for an ounce of rhino horn than you pay for platinum, gold or oil. It's absolutely incredible that the world can be fooled like this. The fact is, it's happening. And when you're offering a man from a tribe that may be from Mozambique to walk into the Kruger Park, track an animal for 5 days, find it, and literally stun it, but not necessarily kill it, but then literally with a machete hack out the horn and leave this animal with his face cut with holes in it and still alive. It's unthinkable. So that prompted me to become part of the Helping Rhinos, and I found a lot of people in the world are willing to stand by me and support me. And the big corporate companies have sent me thousands of whatever the local currency is, dollars or rands, and every penny goes to the fund. And we're having great success. And even Quebeca from the MTN side, the World Bicycle Reach side of the MTN team, gave me six mountain bikes with a value of $2,000 each. And all of those six mountain bikes went to the Rangers in a game reserve in the Eastern Cape, which is down by Durban, south of Durban. And now those guys can ride the fence lines on the bicycle, whereas before they'd walk. And these fence lines are miles long. So they can now ride them. They're armed. And we've had some big success in tracking the poachers. And we've given other people who've had quad bikes provided by us. We have a group of women we call the Black Mambas, the most magnificent women. They put full makeup on to patrol the fences. And they are tremendous. We've got them all the combat uniforms. They're not allowed to carry arms. But at 4:45 every morning of every day, these girls literally walk out, check all the fences for any intruders, because they can only get in one side where I actually live, and they check for any breakage in the fence. And if they find it, they then bring in the guys we trained and paid for to learn to track human beings. And we've caught quite a lot of poachers, and in fact we shot three dead just before Christmas when they came in the middle of the night. So the battle will go on, and we hope the message gets out. But the cyclists have been terrific to me, and there's every sign it's going to continue this year. I've got a couple of sportive rides. We have a rhino jersey now, which is fabulous. Picture of a rhino, two rhinos on the back and the paw prints on the front. And I've signed the jerseys and the printer with my thanks for your support and signature on every jersey they buy. And all that money goes to the Rhino Fund. So,
are they using drones, Phil?
Well, they say they are. Now, I've seen one go past our house in the bush, and we are very remote, and I was wondering who was flying it. But I did find out it was a French film crew, not connected to rhino poaching, but I was very frightened when I saw it, because they're just totally silent, apart from a buzzing noise. It was just flew down the river past our house, and then I was out like a rabbit and found out what was going on. But yes, they've got so much. See, these guys have got huge money. Who are you talking so much money? £300,000 or £400,000 for one horn. Now, that's huge money. And when these guys, the guys at the base level who walk into the field with their rifle, get his rhino horn back safely, would earn more money than ever see in years of working. So there'll always be people willing to risk their lives. We had a guy on our property, a ranger shot him through the hand. They took him to the police. There's not 100% support from the police. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. Within seconds, they're out on bail. And, of course, they don't answer the bail call. But this particular guy was released. And a few weeks later, was shot dead by rangers in the Kruger Park. Same man was at it again while he was on bail for the first offence. So money, I'm afraid, is far more attractive than their own lives.
Tell us where the website is to get involved in that campaign if listeners want to do that.
Well, you can adopt rhinos, and we keep you up to date with progress, because one rhino was virtually dead. The picture's on the website. Horrible to look at, but it's got a happy ending, this one. Her name was Tandy. She was a female, and completely open wound right down the top of her head. And we looked after her. We got money for her. And she gave birth to a calf late last year. So Tandy's got a baby with her now, and it's a wonderful story. It's the nicest side of the whole thing. It's called helpingrhinos.org, simple as that. And you can adopt a rhino, or you can buy one of my jerseys, or you can come and ride with me.
All of those things. How about all of the above?
Yeah, I've had to start training again, because we started out with a toe in the water. Now, in June, I'm riding the first stage of London to Paris. I'm riding some other rides here. I'm going to a ride in Canada to Montreal and so on. So I've had to start training at my age. It must be mad.
No, you're not mad. You're fine. We will post the Saving the Rhinos website on our Facebook page.
Oh, that'd be great, Dana, because I'll tell you, the thing is, we make a big point of it. Every penny goes to the rhinos. We don't keep any back.
I am glad to hear that. I mean, the elephants aren't in good shape, but what they're doing to the rhinos is just so horrific. It's just awful.
And the rhinos are now almost unsustainable in the wild. We're down to about 2,500. But, you know, let's keep them in the wild as long as we can. You don't want to see all your animals in the world in zoos, even where they come from.
I agree. So my last question is, are you going to be coming to the World Road Race Championships in Richmond, Virginia this year?
Well, I did do the World Championships in Spain last year, and I did present the whole thing for the Richmond people, the great people, and they seem to be well switched on with their organization. But at this moment in time, nobody's asked me. So the answer is I don't know. It'll be on, I think it's on NBCSN, but they use American commentators, and it's in America as well. So.
Well, we'll see about that. All right, enjoy your holiday in England, and have a safe trip over to the States for the Amgen Tour. Phil, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been just an incredible pleasure and honor.
It's been all mine, and thank you very much, Diana.
I hope you enjoyed my encore presentation of the conversation I had with Phil Liggett. We will see what happens as the tour unfolds over the next 3 weeks and see who is standing on the podium at the end. Thank you so much for listening this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. My thanks to Aaron Gordon for joining me from Jalopnik to talk about what goes on with the NYPD when a cyclist is killed in New York City. Not a pretty story, but it's nice to know that there's somebody who's not only reporting on it, but is reporting on it from a personal perspective. I'll be back next week with a brand new show. We're going to check in with Tracy and Peter Flukey and find out where they are on their 7,000-mile tandem tour around the country. We'll also be talking with Rob Selasky. He's an intern at Urban 3, a geoanalytics company, and he did some work for Strong Towns. He has two very interesting articles, one about what happens with the roads around lakefront properties, whether they are municipally owned or privately owned, and another about what's been happening in Palm Beach. Remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without an E, or you can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. And if you enjoy the show, won't you please take a moment to rate it at your podcast app? I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.